Hi, I'm Rebecca McEnroy, and I produce This Is Just to Say here at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. And I'm proud of each one of the episodes that we've run, and I continuously am in awe of Carrie and her guests. This show is no exception. While listening to Carrie's interview with Olivia, I was engulfed in this sense of gratitude for her work, her courage to confront her fears and her obsessions, her strength to continue on with her tour amidst threats of violence and hatred. And also her wit and her wisdom really make her a formidable role model for generations of boys and girls. And with that in mind, Carrie and Olivia talk explicitly about the genre of true crime and how troublesome it is. They also swear quite a bit. So if that's something that could be triggering to you in any way or something that you don't want your kids to listen to, please tune out. However, I encourage you to check out Olivia's very important work. Her book, Life of the Party, is out now, and it's published by The Dial Press. Enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
I think I forget how few rules there are in poetry. My name is Olivia Gatwood, and this is my poem, The Sandias, 2008. The only person who knows, and I mean really knows, from even eight states away, a pitch so gentle only he can hear it, my sadness, is my father who, when I was 16 and experiencing my first heartbreak, knew nothing but also knew everything at once. And without asking any questions, took me on the back of his motorcycle and drove us up to the mountains, where in the middle of summer, we rode the ski lift up and down, admiring silently the tall grass and blonde poppies and untouched globes of dandelion florets, and the lonely boy at his summer job who pulled the lever just for us, the only customers, to lift our bodies up this silent beast. And I was too young to point and say, how beautiful, still stuck in my teen religion of black eyeliner, eyes rolling, but knew, despite my denial, that something here was worthy of praise. And I guess that was the lesson. My father, who knows, and I mean really knows, my sadness, knew that I didn't need to be told. I needed to see that despite it all, there was still something alive beneath me.
I love that poem so much.
Thank you.
And one of the things I really admire about it that you kind of, I forgot, and then as you were reading it, I remembered, is that it's one sentence long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, I think I forget how few rules there are in poetry. And every time I read contemporary poetry, I'm reminded of the rules we're allowed to break. So when I was reading, I was on a heavy Ross Gay kick, and I read Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude like 50 times. And there's so many poems in that book that are two sentences, you know, and they're five pages or one sentence. And I'm such a fan of rhythm because I'm a performer, that when a poem is written in one sentence, yet somehow doesn't feel like a run-on sentence because rhythmically it's so intentional. And this poem, I don't remember saying, I'm going to write this in one sentence. I knew it. The story in my mind is so one thought. It's not like a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's just this moment in time that was so significant that it makes sense to me that it happens in one kind of one moment, you know.
Having read this book and having read a lot of your work, you have a great instinct for sentence making, which mm-hmm. is like the unsung true art of poetry, I think, you know.
Yeah,
just making sense, making that, then, and this is a hefty sentence, but it's a sentence, you know.
Yeah. Well, and I think we get that from reading our work out. That's, I think, one of the huge why it's so important to read our work out loud, even if we're not performers, even if our work never leaves the page. At least for me, I always catch when something syntactically isn't working from reading it out loud, not from looking at it on a page. Because if you're hearing the way that, if your breath is falling unnaturally, it's a sign to me that a sentence needs to be broken up somewhere. And so, like, that's at least how I how I figure out if a sentence is working is by reading it out loud, even if that poem is never going to end up on a stage.
Is that how you write your poems?
Out loud.
How often do you stop and read a poem out loud, or, you know, are you always reading it out loud, or how do you do it?
I kind of do it depending on the length of the poem and how quickly it comes out. I will usually just basically as soon as I have, I write in really short bursts. I saw something on Twitter that was a guy mimicking his wife writing. I don't know if you saw this, but it went viral in like the writing world because he was mimicking his wife writing by like doing these really intense moments of typing and then stopping and like looking off into space for like 4 seconds and then going back and typing really intensely. It was hilarious. But I really identified with it and I write like that. And so kind of every time I stop and take a moment, I'll read it out loud, because really nothing bothers me more than writing a ton and realizing whatever it was isn't working.
Mm-hmm. And you don't know if it works until you read it out loud.
Right. And so I have to stop and check in and make sure I'm not wasting my time.
What's amazing to me about that moment, I don't probably read it out loud as much as you're saying. Like I'll work on something and then when I feel like it's at a place, then I start reading it aloud. Mm-hmm. To myself in the room. And it's amazing to me like how much concentrated time I can spend with a poem in my head and on the page, writing and revising and working on the breaks and whatever, just working on the poem, making the poem, mm-hmm. and come to a point where I think, okay, this is at a place where I can read it aloud. And it, you know, you sort of fool yourself into thinking maybe it's done in a way, mm-hmm. or it's come to a point of doneness. And then you read it aloud and also you can like, oh yeah, I used that one word like 5 times in this poem.
Right.
And I didn't hear it. I didn't hear it because I hadn't been speaking it aloud, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of poets can resist that, sort of like it's awkward or it's makes people feel self-conscious, or, you know, it seems unnatural to alone in a room, you know, mm-hmm. be reading something aloud. You know, not everybody is as comfortable with the performative aspect of poetry, even if you're not a performer or ever read your poems aloud. Like poetry in and of itself in some ways is a performance on the page, right?
Of course.
So tell me, okay, and this poem is so beautiful, but in some ways it is different than many of the poems in this book. And what I really mm-hmm. love about you, I mean, there's so much to love about Life of the Party. It's such a great book. It's a hefty
Thank
book
you.
Of poetry as well.
Yeah.
I was just showing Rebecca, like, it's just a long book of poetry. And mm-hmm. I just really appreciate that about it. And there's a novelistic sense about it. The poems hold together on their own, and then the book itself holds together in a different way. And one of the things that I think now every book of poems should have is you wrote a foreword, right? Is it a foreword or an author's mm-hmm. note? Can you talk to me a little bit about like the author's note and sort of how you frame the book before your reader jumps in? Because I think it's a really interesting framing device for the book. And I would love to hear more about where you started with this book and where the book took you as you were working on it.
Yeah, sure. I don't know if it's a quality or a flaw. I mean, I guess all things are both, but I have this deep need at all times to like explain myself. I feel very unfinished if I haven't verbalized what I'm feeling in like a way that's a full thought. So obviously like arguments with my partner turn into me being like, and one more thing. Well, wait a second. Actually, I want to revise what I just said. So I think the author's note was like born in some ways is my personality. But I also the author's note came last, but in some ways it came first, which is that when I was working on this book, I knew that I wanted to write a book of poems about my relationship to true crime and also the role that fear has played in my life. But I hadn't quite written the poems yet. I'd written a couple that kind of echoed those thoughts, but it really wasn't. I had the sort of thesis in my head, but I hadn't, and I'd been able to verbalize it, but I didn't really have the content, honestly. So when I was going around to publishers with the very few poems I had, I did have a really clear vision that I was able to communicate. And that's kind of what sold the book, honestly, it was more of like, I promise I can write this book. Let me just tell you what I want to do. And so when the book was finished, my publisher was like, I remember you having said all of these things about your relationship to true crime and the statistics of true crime and the flaws in true crime and your relationship to it. Can you write something about that? Because while the book does that, she really was intent on, my editor was really intent on the reader getting, having an that be explicitly clear. And I found it really important because I did realize that this book is long and it does cover so much of what it was I initially wanted to say. But there's so much that isn't, to me, just isn't poetic that also needs to be said, you know, and I don't want to say it with the guise of craft. I don't want to say it in metaphor. I don't want to say it in relation even to myself. We're talking about the homicide of women, right? And so I really explicitly wanted to name that to the reader. I wanted to voice my opinion about the prison system and police, because I needed the reader to understand both what they were walking into and also how to walk away from it. So,
just having, you know, I've been in the world of poetry for a long time and I know how it works and I know how books get published. Mm-hmm. And that is 100% opposite of how most books of poetry come to be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's almost like you went out with a book proposal as you write with a book of nonfiction or even maybe like a couple of chapters of a novel and an outline and sold that and then wrote the poems. I've never heard of that before. It's so interesting to think about that. And I love that you knew. You knew that you had those poems in you.
Yeah, I mean, I think poetry is my friend Melissa always says that poetry is obsession. I think there's even a line in the book that says that. And it's so true. And I knew that I was obsessed with this thing. And I knew I had been for years. And I knew that, you just know when you know something. Mm-hmm. And I knew this. And I knew how to talk about it clearly. So I didn't expect this book to come out, which also is how it works often. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think it's surprising when it's one thing to know that something is consuming you and to feel like you understand it. But then when you really decide, like when I was starting to write this book, I was in a phase of really extreme, honestly, paranoia. I was consuming a lot of true crime at the time. I was experiencing a lot of anxiety, and that was being channeled through this incredible fear. And I was living in a first floor apartment. I was often alone, and I was just like kind of spiraling. And what was interesting about this book was instead of resisting that, I thought, I'm writing a book about this, so I'm going to dive into this. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to resist this feeling. I'm going to hold a magnifying glass up to it and figure out where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you learn a lot about yourself and you unearth a lot of memories you didn't know you still had. And so that's sort of what I mean about why this, a lot came out that I just wasn't expecting. And I dove more into my own personal life than I expected to. I thought it was more going to be more leaning towards the cultural criticism from like an outsider's perspective. But instead I ended up doing a lot of internal work.
Isn't it interesting the way that I think that's so true about obsessions in poetry, that you must use your obsessions. And I think so often in like real life in the world, especially women, we're like discouraged from even the experience of obsessiveness or of obsessing, that it's like a mental disorder, right? You can't stop thinking about something. But if we can use our obsessions to figure out, I mean, you know, like obsessions are not random, you know?
Right.
There's something there. And it's, this is one of these books where I mean, I'm not, I'm probably like allergic almost to true crime. My husband, you have an ode to My Favorite Murder, that podcast, right. Which became so popular. There's so many people who love true crime. Maybe love is not the word, but become obsessed with true crime. And, but it's always just felt very like it's true, you know?
Yeah.
It's true crime, you know, like the people who are their photographs are come up on Dateline and you know that, oh, the reason that there's a photograph of that person is because that person is dead now.
Right.
You know, it's just like, it's just too much for me. It's like very, very like, it's just too much emotionally, but, to sort of explore like one's obsession with true crime and where it comes from. Because it's not, you know, it's also like that's not a strange obsession. People are obsessed with true crime. It's there's like an industry built around it, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting to sort of explore it and to see where personally that obsession comes from. But also so much of this book explores where our cultural obsession with true crime comes from and just I just had such a realization that yes, it's so right. Like so much of it is just about the victimization of women.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's what within interrogating my own obsession, I also had, I had several moments while listening to My Favorite Murder where I was listening to some of the live shows and they're in these giant theaters. And I had these brief moments of just like these existential, like, wait, why are thousands of people obsessed with this? And I don't think it's a criticism. That's not coming from a place of a negative criticism, but really, and most consumers of true crime are women. And so we have to ask ourselves why that is. It's just like, we can't be obsessed as a culture with the murder of women, which is most of true crime. And then also most of the consumers of it are women and not ask ourselves where this is coming from. So, and it doesn't sit well with me either. I also don't know how to emotionally handle it, which is also what I had to explore, was why I was being drawn to this thing that felt really harmful to my psyche, and what I needed to get from it, you know.
And that's what I'm like sort of thinking again about that idea of using obsession. And not only in poetry and art making and creating something, but just also in life. Like, why am I obsessed with that? You know, I have a very obsessive personality, and it has served me well in my writing career. Not so much. It feels sometimes not so much in my personal life, you know.
Totally.
You know, you just also think like, well, that if you can start using your like obsessions as a guide to like what is it that I can't quite control that my obsession is helping me access, and that makes sense to me. That the consumers, that most of the consumers of true crime stories, which the stories themselves are so often about the victimization of women, that the consumers are women, because in some way, doesn't it seem like if we can listen to these stories, if we can hear them, that in some way it's like controlling it, right? We can protect ourselves if we just in some way almost like suffer with the victims or try to understand the motivations that men have toward in violence toward women. Can we somehow control it? It's just it was really revelatory to me reading your book, you know. Like I hadn't thought about that. It was really something that was like, oh wow, gosh, this is so true and so interesting. And I think that we can also start to look at true crime through this like feminist lens then, right? I mean, I've never listened to My Favorite Murder, but one of the things that my husband loves about it so much is that he loves that the hosts are feminist, and that it's a feminist eye on true crime. And so, yeah, it's an interesting idea, thinking about how we can reclaim something, you know, that we can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the it's this weird balance, like you said, between like controlling it and also like, in some ways, I feel like I also learn from it, which is not to in any way blame the victim, but that spaces that I've never considered dangerous before, I'm like, oh, I never thought about getting attacked in a parking garage. Okay, now I'm reading this case where that happened. All right, so I'm gonna like file that away into my memory of like some ammo or some knowledge that might help me later. And then there's this also weird element of kind of like seeing yourself in media, and you're like, okay, I guess that could have been me. And I'm watching reading this story about this girl that is my age and did the things I did, and okay, like that could have been me. And there's this weird familiarity in it that we're all seeking in media all the time. And it's weird to think that that can happen even when the person you're looking at is dead. Yeah, so there's so many elements of why women, I think, cling on to it. And it makes, like you said, complete sense.
And there's also this just the strange aspect about true crime. One of the things that I cannot help but think, and it's like an existential thing, again, like on Dateline when they bring up a photograph of someone. Early on in the narrative, and you just go, oh, okay, we know that anytime they're going to show a photograph and it's not a live interview, that means that person's dead, right?
Sure, yeah.
And but like that person lived their life never realizing that they were
Oh,
going
yeah.
to be the subject of a true crime story, or they were going to be, and there's something really like there's a strange invasion of privacy to me, or like a they don't, it's not an invasion of privacy. It's more an invasion of of selfhood, right? That the dead don't get to speak for themselves and say like, no, I don't want to be the subject of your story,
Right. Yeah, and that's the other element I think that was really important for me in this author's note was also naming that an obsession with something does not inherently mean like that it's immune to flaws in my mind, or that or even that I love it. I wouldn't even say I love true crime. That feels like the wrong word, because true crime is really problematic, and it's riddled with actually the opposite of I think honoring dead girls. I think celebritizing dead girls is often feels it can feel sexual. It can feel like romanticizing these girls because now they're eternally young in our brains. Which is something we always want from women, is for them to be eternally young, and now they exist as the most beautiful photograph of them on a television screen. And it was really jarring to me to start to explore this genre and realize I could be one of these girls, and I'm a lot more than just a photo on Dateline. Yet I could very easily become that, and it does very little too to really diagnose the epidemic that is the murder of women in this country, so it yeah, I also have huge issues with it, and the way that the girls are talked about and the way that their murders are talked about and indulged in.
is reminiscent to me in some way, though I can't quite articulate it right now, of pornography
Yeah, sure.
as a genre or as an obsession, a cultural obsession, and just about agency in all of it, who has the agency and
Absolutely.
who is exercising their agency, and who
Right.
is who is being oppressed and who is oppressing, and who is making the profit from
Right.
it. Yeah, it's really complicated. It really is very complicated. I wonder, Olivia, okay, so one thing that I need everyone to know about you, because it's like just, a point of pride on my part, is that you were born and raised in New Mexico, as was I.
Yeah.
You were born in and raised in Albuquerque, the big city.
Yeah. That's so funny.
I know, I know. I was just I love these poems too, because I know all the places in these poems, and I know the I'm one of the things that we haven't talked about, but that's the story of the bodies that were found on the mesa, and the
Sure.
ongoing investigation, lack of investigation, lack of, you know, yeah, sure. The way that story was told over so long a period of time. And you know, I'm from the southern part of the state, so that was also, you know, we were closer to the stories when they came out of all the women's bodies that were being found in Juarez. So it was just sort of happening in all directions. But I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about, like, how you came to poetry. And I also would love it if you could talk a little bit about how you came to performance as well, because you're such a, like, consummate performer of your work. And I wondered if you could just talk about, like, how you see yourself as a performer as well. Like, do you identify as a performer in the same way that, say, like, an actor or actress would consider themselves a performer? Or so that's two questions in one. First,
yeah,
let me just go back and say, could you tell us a little bit about how you came to poetry?
Yeah. Well, first, I want to say when I came to your poetry, it's funny because it's not that there's a lack of narratives of women in New Mexico, but New Mexico often feels like such a weirdly remote state. Like, it just feels like no one's from there when you're not living there. And one of my friends one day was like, "You haven't read Carrie Fountain? Like, what? And I was like, "No." And it was Hugh Nguyen who wrote the book Not Here that came out last year. It's incredible.
I'm totally fangirl over him. I love his
work. He's amazing. Yeah. So he's who showed me your work. And he was like, he's very funny because he's got kind of like an attitude, and he was like almost like annoyed with me that I hadn't heard it yet. Like, he's like, "What's wrong with you? Like, what do you mean? It's like meant for you." And I just like tore your book apart, but in a good way. So, yeah. So speaking of, you know, representation and feeling like, wow, this is that feeling of growing up in this environment, this geographical like place, this weather, this drought, is really incredible.
So. It's really like, don't you feel like it's like growing up inside of, it's like layer upon layer of metaphor being played out in every aspect of that, you know, part of the world. And then also added like these very distinct and interesting racial dynamics, ethnic dynamics, cultures coming together. And I just sometimes feel like every story could be told in New Mexico, and it would be made better by that, you know?
For sure. It's like the most, I mean, it's built, the community is also built on storytelling. Like every single like lesson I ever learned as a kid was told through a story, you know, because it's a community of storytellers. And that's because of, I think, like the cultural intersections, and also the land just like is so old. It's such an old place. Mm. And it's also so haunted.
Yeah. That's funny that you say that, because I really, when I came to be an adult and, you know, the story of, for example, the story of La Llorona is like, you know, people know that story. It's not, it's not only in, you know, in that culture anymore. It's traveled. And people know it as like this, it's like a myth, right? It's like a story. But when I grew up, I honestly, like, people told that story, probably as they did in your part of the state, because the river runs through Albuquerque, just as it runs through Las Cruces. And it was just this story that people would tell to just strike utter fear in the hearts of kids, because the river, the Rio Grande, looks so placid and so easy to jump into. And people drown in it all the time because there are these crazy, you know, undercurrents and things, and it's moving and it's hard to, you know, so the story of La Llorona, I didn't think of it as like a story until I was like, oh, that's just a story. Like, that is actually, I would go to, like, we would go on walks to the river, and I would like I would be like looking out, like, where is she?
Yeah. No, my first grade teacher sat us down and was like, "All right, guys, you can't go in the ditches because of La Llorona, and here's what's up." Like, there was no sense that it was a myth. Like, she told it to us the same way she told us about you know, like the presidents of the United States, yeah. which is like more of a myth. Like the goodness of George Washington is more of a myth than Lyonna in my brain.
You know?
The way we learn about colonizers is more of a myth than
Lyonna. That aspect of it. I mean, there's an Oñate High School in Las Cruces. Like Oñate was like, he was it just doesn't make any sense to me. You know, who gets glorified and who gets forgotten. And
absolutely. And the balance of also the people who are systematically forgotten, like the Navajo Nation, but then their art and their aesthetic is constantly reproduced in New Mexico in ways that can be really respectful and honoring and can also be so exploitative. And it's can be very hard to tell the difference, too.
In Austin, Austin is just like this, like Austin is like this. There's a tidal wave of gentrification that has gone over the city in the last, I mean, many years. It's been coming, I'm sure, for many years, but it's so dramatic. Like, I was driving on this street 2 months ago and it was like a bunch of piñata stores. And now it's like condos. Like, it's literally a totally different place. But in New Mexico, it was like, it's like I, all through my childhood, and my father was really sensitive to it. So it was like something that was always pointed out to me. And, you know, like we'd travel to Santa Fe, we'd go there, and then it would be like, every time we'd go back, it would be like fewer and fewer actual Native Americans and more Native American jewelry being sold by white people. Yep. And just like it was, you know, so it just, the idea that like Santa Fe is a place that was built by by one people, and then white people came in and co-opted the culture and commodified the culture, and now have made it a place where nobody can afford to live in Santa Fe, but
nobody,
like, you know, wealthy white people, you know, it's really mind-boggling, and it happened, and you know, this is something in southern New Mexico that hasn't quite happened yet, and it's like almost like, you know, the stories of like, you know, some people being really worried of like the, like some flood or something happening in the desert. Right. And like, that's how, like, that's the thing that like in my family's history, you know, my family's been there for so long that this idea that like someday it will come to southern New Mexico, you know, that like what happened in Santa Fe will come to us and we will become this like joke of ourselves, you know, and it's so it's like very present. It's a very, and every time I go back, every time I go home, I just think like I can, I'm very sensitive to it. Like, oh, here's this, and here's this, and these are the, you know, Las Cruces is really, really, it's much, much less, it's poorer than in southern, than it is in, you know, up in the northern part of the state. So maybe it won't come as quickly, but it will come, you know.
But there is that, I think. Yeah, I don't know that it will come, maybe or maybe not. I'm always shocked by the possibilities of gentrification and the rate at which it moves. But there is this romanticization, too, of the smaller towns in New Mexico that I've noticed cropping up, you know. Even, like, I don't really know much about, this is Southwest, but I'm about to go on tour, and I have a date in Marfa, Texas. And I don't know about, like, Marfa as a community or how it was founded, but I imagine it started as a very small community. And I don't know if it was started as an artist community. What I do know is that it's the most expensive town on all of tour. And we're staying in cities like Seattle and San Francisco, and Marfa, Texas is the most expensive. And when I tell you the most expensive lodging is a teepee at like this white artist commune. I have fundamental issues with a teepee being $250 a night. And I think that's an example for me. Like, when I was looking at it, I was like, oh, so this is kind of what will also start to happen as white people start deciding to move away from cities, is smaller towns will become kind of these like niche, cutesy areas for white people to feel off the grid. When we're very much not living off the grid, you know? So like, I was like, is this where we have to stay? And then my boyfriend actually was like, well, what if you do end up having to stay there, you should stay there and then like match the cost that you spent there and donate it to like an organization that you know, assists in the search for missing Indigenous women in the United States, you know, as a way of like offsetting that or something. But I was really struck by that. And I don't know the history of Marfa, but I worry about small towns in New Mexico becoming kind of situations like that.
I think Silver City is next to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Silver. We were just there in Silver City. It definitely seems that way.
Oh, God. It's such a heartbreaker, too, because that town is so deep in my heart. And we spent a summer there, not this summer, last summer. And, you know, it's just, I just thought, oh, this is the next Marfa. Because it's, you know, it's like, it's suffering a little bit, you know, it's struggling. Mm-hmm. And there are all these spaces available for cheap, you know, and it's just such a beautiful place. Such a beautiful place.
Yeah, it's a really cool town. I grew up going to poetry slams there. Oh, I guess I'm supposed to talk about
poetry. Oh, yeah. Okay. So wait, actually, yes. So I'm just going to, again, tell me how you came to poetry. Yeah. And then I do want to talk a little bit about like your experience as a touring poet, because I think that is something that people don't know how it works. And I'm so fascinated by it. And I'm like a little bit of a fangirl for you. So I want to talk to you about that. But first, just tell us how you came to poetry, you came to write poetry.
Sure. Yeah. So I was introduced to poetry when I was 10 years old. I lived in Trinidad in the Caribbean for 3 years for primary school. And it was there that I was introduced to poetry. We just had a poetry unit and we were, it was very simple in terms of the actual story, but I had never felt so electrified by something immediately. As soon as we started reading and learning about poetry, and because we were young, we were learning about, you know, Shel Silverstein and like ABAB rhyme schemes. And I felt immediately like I understood it. It was like, I know what this is. I know what this demands, and I know how to do it. And I went home and I did it. And I wrote a poem that about my brother protesting my brother's treatment of me, and then brought it to school and performed it, and was really insistent about performing it. For some reason, I was not a stage child. I was not an extrovert. I didn't sing or dance, but I just like had this deep need to control the way that people heard me. And so, and then my teacher actually accused me of plagiarizing it. She was
"Oh my God, this is so, I had this exact same experience as
did
a,
you
in middle school."
Really?
Yes, and it was a teacher who it was almost the exact opposite, because it was like so unperformative, and I wrote a poem, and it was in the opening page of the yearbook in my middle school, and it was a terrible poem, I'm sure, and I can prove it because I'm sure I still have that, but I didn't want my name to be on it because I was so self-conscious, and they published it, and then my teacher was like, "I know why you didn't want to put your name on that poem. It was because you obviously didn't write that poem," and my parents were so fucking hands off. It was like kind of
mine were
like
too,
to my detriment.
Me too.
When I went home and told my mom that I had been accused of plagiarism, she'd never been to the school before, and she went there and she was like, "Oh no."
Wow.
And she like, and my teacher had to like apologize to me in this really kind of like, she was so pissed because I don't think she ever believed that I did not plagiarize this terrible poem. It was just a really bad metaphor. I think it was like likening middle school to riding a roller coaster, if I remember
correctly. Wait, my first poem as a teenager was, I guess it's not that original, but I was also comparing middle school to a roller coaster.
Shut up.
Yeah, to the wooden roller coaster at Cliffs Amusement Park.
Yes. Well, we had one ours wasn't at Cliffs, but it was at, it was in El Paso. It was called El Diablo.
Oh, wow.
The wooden roller coasters. Yeah. Oh, gosh. Isn't that so funny? Okay.
That's
such a coincidence, but I didn't mean to, I didn't mean to interrupt
you.
No, but
that's
go ahead.
Okay. That's so funny. Yeah. I always feel self-conscious saying that detail because I feel like I'm bragging. I'm like, oh, she thought I plagiarized it, but it was a really important part of that experience. But because honestly, to me, it signified like I did something right. And I was like, I wasn't the best student, and I wasn't ever particularly really great at anything. I didn't feel like I just wasn't like, I kind of, like you said, my parents were really hands off, which meant they let me quit everything I tried if I didn't feel like doing it. And so I just like wasn't really, I didn't really know what my thing was, you know? And when I found poems, it was like, this is my thing. But of course, you're not really taught that that's something you can pursue. And so I stopped doing it and I just did it privately in a journal. I never really brought it out to the forefront. And then I was really into soccer my whole life. I started playing soccer when I was like six and had the same experience with it. It was something that when I learned it, I understood it, and then started to gradually develop at soccer in a way that felt promising. And I was kind of like, oh, I'm going to go to college for it and I'm going to get a scholarship for it. But halfway through my high school year, I got really sick of the wealth related to soccer. There was a lot of class politics and dynamics. I didn't grow up wealthy, and I was playing in a really wealthy league, and I was sick of the gender dynamics of it. Just having male coaches that were doing things that felt really exploitative to us as young girls and our bodies as a tool to help some older guy, you know, live some dream that he'd created for himself. And it just like stopped being worth it. And I didn't have the language then to know why I had grown to hate it so much, but I did. And I knew I needed something to turn to because I was about to leave the thing that my whole life revolved around. And my friend who in science class that we'd cipher together. We liked to freestyle rap together. Just like privately, he was like, there's a poetry club, you should come with me. And so I went with him, and I had heard of spoken word, but I didn't really know it was a thing. But it was what I had been doing the whole time. And when I saw that there was this space where teenagers were encouraged to write what they felt in an uncensored way and say it out loud in front of an audience of people, I just couldn't believe it. Because it was the opposite of what I'd been conditioned to believe we were allowed to do as teenagers. I went to a huge public high school, and it was like, there were just like, it just felt constantly like you were just being silenced and you were just should do follow the rules and do what you were told, especially with soccer and organized sports. And I was like, oh, you mean I just get to say whatever I want? I can be angry. I can talk openly about these things that bother me. And I do it in the form of a poem. And then I read it out loud and everyone's doing that. Like, hell yeah. And then introduced the competition part with slam. And I had come from a sports background. So it was like, it was truly like I'd found my soulmate. And I just became obsessed with it. And it was all I did I literally never stopped. It just consistently was my life. And I never thought it was going to be something that I had income from or how I would pay my rent. But I just kept doing it. And come college, it was like some videos got on YouTube, and that's when people started offering me to come perform at their schools. And I knew that it was something when I was calling out of my waitressing job to go to perform poems at colleges more often than I was actually at my waitressing job. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's so fascinating what you just said about playing soccer and like the weird gender dynamics. Mm-hmm. I mean, God, this has been an actual like headline story with the women's soccer team and the way they've been treated and compensated poorly. And I think one of the things that I find remarkable about your work is the way that you approach ideas of gender dynamics and like sexuality, you know, in your work. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, like, I both want to hear like how you approach it. And then also, I'm always fascinated and sometimes horrified to hear about people's responses when women actually take the spotlight and say, like, you know, your poem Ode to My Bitch Face, that is the poem probably, right, that you're most, that like, you're, that has had the most views online or whatever. Is that right? Am I right about that? Like, you know, so I love that poem, and it's such a celebration of this deeply female experience, and it feels like a reclaiming, and it feels like a empowering thing. And I'm sure that there are people who write you and tell you, shut the fuck up, bitch. Right? mean, I can imagine just because I've been on the internet.
Sure. Yeah. Totally.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about not only writing and approaching like issues of sexuality and gender, but also performing those and being in a very public space with them in a way that maybe not all poets are, you know?
Yeah. I think, you know, I have had a really complicated, and all, I think all women have had a really complicated experience with sexuality and the balance between wanting to be desired and needing to be desired, and what it does for me and what it doesn't do for me. And I think that has been influenced by so many things throughout my life, but I've always felt this really intense awareness of it. And it has been, but simultaneously has been really hard to resist. So I guess what I mean is I think I spent actually a lot of my young life deeply catering to boys and men and their approval of me while also knowing what I was doing. And it was this weird, I did not know how to navigate it as a young person. And the way that I figured it out was through writing, because it was felt so incredibly nuanced and complex. And every single time I learned more about, like the first time I took a women's studies class, it was like, oh shit, like there's language for these things. There's something called slut shaming, you know, or whatever. And I had to learn about my own, the ways I had been slut shaming women and girls. And then, you know, you keep moving like beyond the 101 and things just get more and more complex and messy and clear at the same time. And I think writing has really helped me understand why I operated the way I did as a 15-year-old girl, who was a sexual 15-year-old girl, and the ways in which I wanted to be that, and also the ways in which I didn't and was pressured into being that, and how that has lived inside of me. And I'm constantly unlearning. I feel like eternally affected by a very specific time frame in my life from my teenage years. And so poems have for me been, it's actually a very like personal experience, and I feel really grateful that it's resonated with people, because when I'm writing them, I'm actually not really thinking about an audience at all. I'm thinking about myself, and I'm thinking about how I can best explain what I was possibly, you know, thinking when I was engaging in these behaviors, and the men I was surrounding myself with, and how I felt, because it's really easy, I think, to just kind of talk about it as though there's only several narratives. There's like, you're either, it's like this virgin whore paradigm, and or you're either like a victimized young girl that was exploited by men, or you're like a girl that put herself in those positions and was, you know, gaining power from it. And I didn't experience one of those things. I experienced all of them. And so writing poems has just really helped me understand that nuance and let me live in that nuance through just honestly remembering and telling the story how it happened, instead of telling the story as some sensationalized headline. So there's that.
I like that. I love what you just said about, you know, that dynamic, and maybe it's not, I mean, it is complicated, even beyond the cliche of like, the virgin whore dichotomy,
paradigm.
I mean, it's so much more complicated. And
sure.
I think one of, you know, I think so much what happens in your work is, you know, there's a sort of expected way that maybe women can talk about reclaiming their sexuality that is like, that does feel kind of for maybe lack of other, you know, examples, like very aggressive and very like I'm hyper self-possessed, you know,
right?
And or else like the, like I'm a victim of, and the, like that area in between where the experience of being a human being lies, not just the experience of being a sexual or, you know, a sexual person with a gender. So I think it was one of the things that comes to my mind is just thinking about one of the many dichotomies and one of the many things that we get pigeonholed into as women is the sort of notion that older women are supposed to sort of just really feel hyper allergic to younger women because they pose such a threat to them, because really, if we're all competing in this paradigm for, you know, who is and remains for, you know, and this is not for lack of a better term. I think this is a totally appropriate term, and I think we need to own it and use it, fuckable, right?
Yeah.
But one of the things that I love so much about your work, and just, I just think when I was my daughter is 9, she just turned 9. When I was a teenager, I didn't have voices like that. I wasn't reading. I couldn't go onto the internet and read Ode to My Bitch Face and have that kind of crazy paradigm shift where you go oh my God, you know, like this thing that I have been made to feel ashamed of, like I can own it and I can be bigger and messier and more complicated than anyone can even imagine, right? And I can also let go of that shame, you know, like shame is just such a useless emotion. The experience of being a woman is so saturated, I think, with that, just inherently, just in the way that we're socialized and brought up. Like, it just makes me feel very hopeful and wonderful about and not to put too much on your shoulders, but you are going to be, and you are already a beacon to younger women beyond you, who are going to be able to say I found this work when I was 15 and it, you know, it changed my life. I definitely feel that way about a poet like Sharon Olds, total paradigm shifter for me in my day and age. But she wasn't doing the same thing as you are. You know, it just makes me feel really hopeful for the next generation of girls and women. We have to keep opening it up, and we have to keep making it bigger, and we have to keep making the arena bigger, and we have to keep making the space where those voices and those unutterable utterances to be said. We have to keep it open, you know? So I just feel like that's something that you do so wonderfully. And I just so thanks for that. And not just thanks for me, but thanks from my daughter and the, you know, girls beyond that. Because I think it really is something that is life changing, you know, and one life changed, it means that that's how big changes happen, you know, that's how we change paradigms, you know?
It got me thinking about the audience reactions that you were asking about with people responding on the internet, and it actually has me thinking about who we write for. And I actually think in the beginning, similar to I think we're to this virgin whore paradigm, like you said, we're often pressured, I think, to choose which kind of woman we want to be. And it's either you're a submissive, quiet woman that doesn't have any opinions, or you're overly, you know, I'm not fucking ashamed of my body. I love my body. Like this kind of really intense, and I'm neither, you know, or some days I'm one or some days I'm the other. And most days I'm in the middle. Right. And I think I used to write from a place of, I think I used to write when I was younger in protest for men. I wrote so men would understand where I was coming from, and not in a gentle way, but in a way, in a really deeply resistant way. That's awesome. And I pride my younger self for doing that. But actually, I had a really eye-opening experience. And I'm being careful to not blame myself or blame anyone who gets harassed on the internet. I was writing so many poems that were trying to confront misogyny face to face. And I had this really crazy experience where one of my poems that was about masturbating got on the front page of one of the most prominent men's rights activist websites. And I was proceeded to, they do something where they I was basically doxxed, which is where they try to get you to shut down all of your social media by bombarding it on every platform, and then also getting your access to your personal information. And I just had hundreds and hundreds of messages on every platform, platforms I didn't even know, I didn't even use anymore, like old email accounts and even like Tumblr messages, but Twitter and Instagram and all of it, Facebook, of just death threats and rape threats, and from mostly probably like young men in basements, like gamers, not, no offense to gamers, but a lot of these guys were gamers. Okay. But anyway, not all gamers. Okay. So, but it was really eye-opening because I was also on tour and I was posting my location every single day. And I was like, these are the guys that show up with semi-automatic weapons and kill people. They are, it's been proven. These are men actively talking about murdering women in forums, and several of those men have gone and done that. And so my fear is not irrational, and I'm getting active death threats every day. And I'm also saying, I'm at this school tonight, come to this lecture hall to see me perform these poems that so many people are threatening to kill me over. So I had to kind of stop promoting, and I just did the tour, and I was like in fear the whole time, and it was really traumatic. But after that, I stopped writing for men and I started writing for girls. And I was like, I just thought, you know, I'm not interested in forcing people who want me dead to try to understand my body or like my experience. I would rather validate 13-year-old girls that don't know if it's normal that they made out with their best friend at a sleepover. That's what I care about, you know. I don't care about these like these violent, you know, incels that's like a term I just learned about anyway, involuntary celibate.
Yeah,
so
right.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I just was like, I don't, that's not the hill I want to die on, quite literally.
Right.
So
I think also there's a dynamic there. I've heard people talk about it because I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is like another mm-hmm. figure who gets the same kind of attention from
sure.
the same kind of men. So and seems also very uninterested in
yeah.
catering to them or changing their minds. And I think there's something also about your attractiveness and your like you're totally an hashtag influencer, and you're just like this yeah. beautiful young woman. And I think I think there's something even like there's like a button, there's like another level of their anger that gets turned on by that, because you're not, you don't even have the decency to be hideously ugly. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah, I had a man walk up to a merch table one time and he slammed his hands down on the merch table. And he literally yelled, "I'm attracted to you and I'm also intimidated by you. What the fuck are you going to do about it?" He literally yelled that at me.
Wow.
And it was like the most eye-opening. I was like, do you hear yourself?
Yeah.
Like, this is not my problem. And then he insisted on standing next to me during the merch line, and I had to have him removed.
God.
Because he was so intent on intimidating me, because he was so angry that he couldn't grapple with his attraction to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the most, it's just, yeah. yeah.
That reminds me of I think it's in Tina Fey's memoir, she's talking mm-hmm. about Amy Poehler and the first time she met Amy Poehler in the writer's room at Saturday Night Live. And Amy Poehler made some like very, like sort of like some sort of like vulgar joke about mm-hmm. probably about her vagina or something.
Yeah.
And one of the male, Rebecca's nodding, so she's, was it Jimmy Fallon? I thought it was Jimmy Fallon. So it sort of like was like, oh, that's so gross. Like, ew. And he was like, you know, made some comment about it. And I think he even said like, that's not even funny. And she
oh, wow.
turned to him. So Tina Fey is remembering Amy Poehler turning to Jimmy Fallon and saying, oh, it wasn't for you. That's not
right,
for you.
Right.
But
oh,
just
good.
Like the sort of idea that like, oh, that wasn't for you. And that in Tina Fey's mind, that was a big shift for her, a big turning point for her. I would like to hear a woman say like the idea that it's not for you, you know?
Sure.
And
yeah.
Yeah.
And we have to interrogate that as writers too. Like, I don't know if you've been told this, but I've been told so many times that I don't write, that my books are not accessible to men and that that's a problem. I've been told that by women and I've been told that by men. I've been told that by editors, not my current editor, whom I love deeply, but I've been told that by previous editors. I've been told that by family members. And I just like had to get to a point where I was like, cool, then I've done my job. Great. I don't want my book to be accessible to men. It doesn't need to be because literature historically has been.
Yeah.
So like, fuck it. You know, I don't know.
And then we've got to we've got to investigate those areas too. When I was writing my YA novel, so I was like very firmly in the world of academic poetry, you know, and academia. And I made a very big shift, very conscious shift in my life to leave academia and to sort of commit myself to a life of writing. And I really wanted to write this novel and I wanted to write novels and I wanted to write beyond poetry, you know, novels, screenplays, bigger things, not bigger things, but, you know, different things. And so for like, a couple of years, I wasn't teaching and I was writing this novel and then it sold and I was working with my editor. And when I wrote the novel and then I got an agent by way of the novel, who is a like powerhouse woman. And then she sold it to my editor, who is another just powerhouse, like brilliant, both of them. And then, she happens to be an editor at Flatiron Books, which is owned by Amy Einhorn, I think it's how you pronounce her name, who is like super powerhouse, you know. And so it's like, and then that's my like hierarchy now. Like there's my agent and my editor and the publisher. These are all like amazingly powerful women. And then what we're doing here in this space is we are making books and literature and words for a very specific audience of younger women. And it was just like, I was like, oh my God, I wandered into this amazing utopia, you know? Mm-hmm. And there was a night that I went out for a reading in Austin and I was invited to go out to dinner with the poet after. And it was, he's a lovely person and he's a younger man and a good friend. And we were eating dinner and one of the older poets who was at the table, a man, shocker, initiated as this particular poet is wont to do, a totally infuriatingly meaningless argument meant solely to provoke others, you know. I fucking always fall for it, hook, line, and sinker. But this particular argument was that women would rape men if they could. Like, so the argument was like women, you know, have those instincts as well, those terrible instincts of that lead men to perpetrate sexual violence, which is not, you know, it's not about sexuality. It's about power and it's about, you know, wielding power over others. But also the other part of the argument is that we would do that if we could, like if we were just a little bit stronger or, you know, if we just put our willpower to it or something. And I just had this moment in that dinner where I first of all stood back and said, I'm not going to engage in this ridiculous argument with this person who is like, you know, this is a very important person in the world of poetry. But I also just stood back and I thought, I felt so like, oh my God, I just want to go home to my like YA world with my these women and I don't like ever have to write another word for a man.
Fuck,
you know? Like I have no argument to make to that person. And that was like a real turning point for me, just sort of going like, oh my God, like I honestly, like I'm not just saying like, yeah, I'm tough and I don't give a shit. I'm honestly in my heart of hearts saying like, I don't give a shit. Like, that is not my audience. Like, I really don't care. I really don't care. In fact, it kind of makes me feel a little bit giddy if you, the more and more I obviously provoke something in you. you're going to be bringing this. And now I can actually, like, I have this sort of perspective where I can even go like, oh, that's actually kind of funny, you know?
Right.
But now the thing that we need to do is move those markets up the inherent hierarchy in the world of literature. There should be a Pulitzer Prize for young adult fiction, or there should not be a distinction between young adult fiction and other kinds of fiction.
Right.
You know, it's about value, right? No, what I was going to say, though, now I think because now I'm sure that you have other things that you have to do and I have to go as well. I wonder if, did you bring a poem to share?
I did, yeah.
Okay. Well, great. I'm not going to ask you any questions about it other than to ask if you would read it to us and if you wouldn't mind just saying the name of the poet before you go into it.
Yeah. Okay. So this poem is very resonant to me right now, but it's by Ada Limón and it's called The Last Move. It was only months when it felt like I had been washing the dishes forever. Hardwood planks under the feet, a cord to the sky. What is it to go to a we from an I? Each time he left for an errand, the walls would squeeze me in. I cried over the non-existent bath mat, wet floor of him, how south we were, far away in the outskirts, all the new bugs. I put my apron on as a joke and waltzed around carrying a zucchini like a child. This is Kentucky, not New York, and I am not important. This was before we got the dog even, and before I trusted the paralyzing tranquilizer of love stuck in the flesh of my neck. Back home in my apartment, another woman lived there, in Brooklyn by the deli where everything was clean and contained, where I grieved my deaths. I took to my hands and knees. I was thinking about the novel I was writing, the great heavy chest of live animals I had been dragging around for years. What's life? I made the house so clean, shine and shine and shine. I was suspicious of the monkey sounds of Kentucky's birds, judging crackles, rusty mailbox, spiders in the magnolia tree, tornado talk, dead June bugs like pinto beans. Somewhere I had heard that, after noting the lack of water pressure in an old hotel in Los Angeles, they found a woman's body at the bottom of the cistern. Imagine just thinking the water was low, just wanting to take a shower. After that, when the water would act weird, spurt or gurgle, I'd imagine a body, a woman, a me, just years ago, freely single, happily unaccounted for, at the lowest curve of the water tower. Yes, and over, I'd press her limbs down with a long pull until she was still.
Damn, that poem.
It's so amazing.
Is that from Bright Dead Things?
Yeah, is from Bright Dead Things. Yeah. I just moved across the country with my boyfriend and I'm working on a novel and have been feeling really isolated kind of in a small town, but also very free and happy. But it's this, I had loved that poem before having this experience, and then I read it recently and was like, oh my God. And how do you put something like that to words?
Yeah,
I have
no idea.
She's
incredible. She's incredible. She's such a gifted poet.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She truly is gifted. She's also just a gifted person, you know? She's just we've interviewed her twice now on this show. She's our only person who we've had on twice. Well, Jose.
Oh, wow.
Oh, Naomi and Jose. She just is so lovely. She's just wonderful.
Yeah.
She's so easy to talk to and I just adore her. Mm. I love that poem. Thank you so much for sharing that poem.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I love that poem so much.
God, it ends just so, it's devastating. Mm-hmm. It's devastating. And that's one of the things that when a poem turns like that, it's just you just think oh my gosh, how did she do that? How did she do it? She's amazing. She's just amazing.
I love that she's not grieving her relationship. She's she's not upset or unhappy in her relationship. She's exploring the nuance of grieving a former self while also being present. It's such a complicated feeling, and I love that she makes room for that.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, the right. Yeah. She's a poet like that too, where she just defies so many kind of expectations, I think, maybe that people have about her as a person as well. You know, she has some great poems. She has a great poem in her newest book, The Carrying, called In the Contract, they say they want the conversation to be bilingual. And it's all about this sort of coded way that poets of color and writers of color are asked to kind of perform their ethnicity in stage appearances and in readings, which is just really great. Oh, well, gosh, man, what a crescendo to have you and to be able to talk to you and then to bring Ada into it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. This is so fun. I'm so excited to interview you, like, just personally.
I know. I feel like we could have talked for like another million years.
Yeah, I want to.
We will in the future. Okay. Yeah, thank you so much, Olivia. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye.
You can find Olivia Gatwood's poem, The Sandias 2008, in her new book, Life of the Party, published by The Dial Press. This is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.